is brought to you by Head Start Basketball.
You need to have a plan for how you would go about playing, how you're going to treat your players, you know, how you structure a program, how you structure your practices. Who are you as a coach?
Bart Lundy is entering the seventh season of his second stint at Queens University of Charlotte and his 12th year overall as the winningest coach in Queens basketball history. After leading his team to a third consecutive 30-win season in 2018-2019, Lundy holds a record at Queens of 263-86 and an overall coaching record of 359-173 in 17 seasons as a head coach at the NCAA Division I and Division II levels. Lundy first took over the Queens program at the age of 25 after helping then-head coach Dale Lehr as an assistant for 2 years. In his first stint as head coach from 1998 to 2003, Lundy took the Royals to their first regional title and an Elite Eight appearance in 2001, and he followed that success with a trip to the national semifinals in 2003. Lundy began his coaching career at Winthrop University, where he graduated with a Master of Arts in 1998. Bart coached at High Point University, where he served as head coach for 6 seasons from 2003 to 2009, taking over the program at age 31, making him the second youngest NCAA Division I head coach in the country. In his first year, Lundy was named the 2004 Division I National Rookie Coach of the Year. Lundy also coached at Marquette University in Milwaukee, where he assisted head coach Buzz Williams for 3 seasons from 2009 to 2012. During that time, Marquette made 3 consecutive NCAA tournament appearances and 2 straight Sweet 16s, with a roster that featured 8 future NBA players, including All-Star Jimmy Butler of the Miami Heat and Jay Crowder of the Memphis Grizzlies. Lundy returned to Queens after a 1-year stint at the University of North Texas, where he served as an assistant to first-year head coach Tony Benford and helped develop NBA first-round pick Tony Mitchell. In addition to success on the court, Bart has graduated 90% of his student-athletes who finish their eligibility, with 100% on track to graduate entering their final season. After you finish listening to this episode, please leave us a 5-star rating and review on your favorite podcast app. Those ratings help others in the basketball community to find our show. Make sure you subscribe to the Hoopheads podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, Spotify, or Google Play so you never miss an episode. Have your notebook handy as you listen to this episode with Bart Lundy, head men's basketball coach at Queens University in Charlotte, North Carolina. Hello and welcome to the Hoopheads podcast. It's Mike Klinzing here with my co-host Jason Sunkel. And tonight we are pleased to welcome to the podcast Bart Lundy from Queens University in Charlotte, North Carolina. Bart, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Mike. Jason, how are you guys doing?
We're great. Good. Thanks for asking. We're very excited to get a chance to have you on the show, talk a little bit about your basketball journey. You've got a few unique things in your coaching background that we'll dig into as we get later on into the podcast. But I want to start out by talking to you a little bit about how you got into the game of basketball as a kid and what made you fall in love with the game.
Well, I grew up in a football family, I think that basketball, football, and baseball—that's kind of what my dad knew, he coached my brother and I in those sports, and he didn't know much about basketball, I think basketball kind of fit my personality. I was a little bit of a loner, we moved around a good bit. So a lot of times I was the new kid and with hoops, all you need is really a ball. Sometimes I didn't even have the hoop, but really a ball and a hoop. And, you know, you've got hours of work you can do. So that really was the start of it for me. And it just kind of became a compulsion, as I grew up. I was, beyond a gym rat. I lived and breathed it and was always doing something, the Pistol Pete stories and, you know, carrying the ball around town. And that was what I wanted to be. And then I had an uncle, his name is Ralph Lundy, and he's been the soccer coach at the College of Charleston for, I don't know exactly, 30 or so years. He's actually retiring this year, and the family and I'll head down in a couple of weeks, and they're going to dedicate the field to him. And then he gets to coach on that field for the remainder of the season. But I got to, at the time when I was growing up, he was at a small school in South Carolina called Erskine College. And it's in Due West, South Carolina, and it's actually due west of nothing. But it was a great place to go spend a few weeks, and I would stay at his house and or stay in the dorms a lot of times by myself. And I'd go to basketball camp, and I was around it, and I saw him interact with his players. And I think that's where the seed of, you know, hey, I want to do this for a living, and I want to do it on a college campus began. So, you know, from there, I went to 5 different high schools with family moves, played with some really good high school coaches, a guy named Larry Parrish at Southern Durham, who was one of the original guys that started Prep Stars basketball camp with Dick DiVincenzo. So I kind of grew up with, you know, that camp, and then moved on. I only played 1 year for him, but he always brought me back to the camps. And then ended up graduating from Hickory High School in Hickory, North Carolina. And from there went to UNC Pembroke and was recruited and coached by a guy named Dan Kenny. After my sophomore year, Coach Kenny left and took the Winthrop job in Rock Hill, South Carolina. I transferred from Pembroke to Lenoir Rhyne, which was kind of back home. And after I finished there, I went to Coach Kenny at Winthrop, gave me my first job. And, you know, that's kind of how I started. And, you know, had a really good high school career, even though it was very scattered, and had just a very average college career. Probably some athleticism caught up to me, but played for some terrific coaches and had a great experience.
What's your best memory from, let's start with high school and then we'll go to college. What's your best playing memory from high school and your best playing memory from college?
Well, I'll tell you, so I grew up, I didn't really start moving until about ninth grade. And so I grew up in the mountains, really way up in the mountains in the Appalachian Mountains in Virginia, a small town called Galax. And then we moved to Durham. You know, I thought I was a really good player and, we moved after school ended and I played the first summer league game and they put me on varsity right away. And, there was only one other kid my age that was on varsity and, I played against him the very first game of summer league and his name was Rodney Rogers. And I realized at that point I wasn't on the mountain.
Well, that's a little bit different level there. Rodney Rogers, the lefty. I remember him. He actually, I'm pretty sure that when I worked at Michael Jordan's flight school, that Rodney Rogers was one of the other counselors that was there the week that I was there. I'm almost positive he was there. Jason's looking at me. He's a little younger than us. He has no idea who that is. So
no idea. Did you ever meet Fred Whitfield when you were working those camps?
I did not. I had my contact that got me in there was a guy named Jerry McGinty. Mm-hmm. Who was good friends with Ed Janka from Nike. So those were the guys that ended up getting me my ticket in there. And I've said this before, but the most disappointing part of that whole experience to me was it was great. Got to see Jordan, got to stand probably within like 2 feet of him. And but he usually typically played with all the kids, the counselors at the end of camp on the last night. And the week I was there, he didn't play. And the hot rumor going through the dorm of all the college guys was that we were told that he was out at the casinos with Mike Ditka gambling on the night that he was supposed to be playing with us. So it was a little bit disappointing. My brush with Michael Jordan was taken away. I had to settle for walking down the hallway next to him once. So
I can give you not trying to one up, but I'll give you my Michael Jordan story. So
all right, I'm ready.
I go to Campbell University basketball camp, and it was really big in those days. You know, it had started with Press Maravich and Michael Jordan was at Carolina. He was a player, and he came in and the counselors played pickup. They were all college players. and they played pickup at night, and the kids would watch the pickup game. And Michael came in. He hadn't been at camp yet, but he came in probably a couple games in. And when he walked in the gym, he stretched a little bit, and then he went and subbed himself in. And there was a little point guard, probably 5'9", really stocky, fast. And Michael, without really being loose, picks him up full court, turns him, rips him from behind, kind of how he used to reach over and, you know, be able to rip you when you got behind. And goes, you know, gets the steal and goes and leans and the gym erupted. They may never have heard an eruption like that at Campbell since. But,
that's awesome.
It was pretty special. It's burned into my mind.
He's a maniacal competitor. So I'll tell you my story from, I don't think I've told this one on the podcast, Jason. This is a new one. So while I was there, Jordan did play one-on-one against some of the campers. And so he played, you know, a bunch of kids, and obviously he's known for his, you know, ruthless desire to win. So it wasn't one of those situations where he was letting kids score. I mean, kids would be trying to score and he'd blocking their shots and making jump shots over them and doing all this stuff. So probably you get to about the sixth or seventh kid that's playing one-on-one against him, and kids got the ball, drives down the right side, comes up underneath on the left side and like throws the shot up over his head. It bounces on the top of the backboard and it bounces in. And so of course the camp's going crazy, you know, that this kid scored on Jordan. And you can kind of see like he's smiling, but you can just tell that he didn't like it that this kid scored. So he gets the ball, and so he's at the top of the key, checks it up with the kid, and he starts doing his, you know, he's jabbing the kid, he's sticking the ball out like old fashioned Dr. J with the one hand, and he's moving the ball around and gets the kid. So he kind of fakes the kid out to the left a little bit, takes the ball to the right, and as the kid's trying to recover, kid goes down sort of underneath the basket. Jordan jumps over him and dunks. And the whole camp, I mean, the camp went crazy when the kid scored. And then when he jumped over this kid to dunk, it was just, I mean, it was crazy. The whole place, just like kids were falling all over each other, jumping up, running around. It was crazy. But it was just, again, a glimpse of, he didn't like it that the kid scored. And so he had to, you know, he had to event. I don't know. The kid was maybe like, he was young. It wasn't a high school kid. It was probably a kid who was like, I don't know, 11, 12, 13.
Oh yeah. He probably was really mad.
Somewhere in that range. So yeah, it was interesting. It was very interesting. It was a fun experience to be there and just be a part of, you know, getting to be a part of that. It's amazing how much those old school camps, you know, the fact that they just don't exist anymore. And I know just from talking to you in this brief time, how impactful that was on your development as a player. And I always felt that way myself. I went to Ohio State's camp a lot when I was a kid, and there's a guy named Bill Hoskett who played for Ohio State probably in the 60s. And he used to have a camp here at Denison University that I would always go to when I was younger. And so those had such a profound impact on me. Talk a little bit about maybe your camp experiences and how important that was in your development as a player, and probably even as your development as a coach.
Yeah, you know, it's I think I might have been at the very end of when, you know, obviously I had the camps growing up. I laugh at our guys now when, you know, they complain about zigzags and things. We'd go to summer camp and at the high school, and before I was even in high school, and the high school coach was a great high school coach, and he had the Dirty Dozen, and we do a dozen different full court slide drills, and you're in summer basketball camp. And, you know, I can't imagine, you know, I don't think I could get my own guys to do it now, much less a bunch of little kids, but
for sure.
Got to be a part really of the Prep Stars movement. They had great players. And went there for all the years of high school. And then, you know, five-star, went to several different sessions of five-star. And, you know, that was terrific because you had the not only the competition and the recruiting aspect, but, you know, back then they were really had great coaches that were trying to teach you the game. And so, you know, the camps were always a big part of how I grew up in the game and how I learned to play. And, you know, a lot of times it was outside, a lot of times it was hot. I remember people making fun of my shoes because my shoes always had the holes in the toes. I was always playing outside and I was poor.
Did you use shoe goo? See, I always used, my dad was a runner, so he always used the shoe goo, that like goopy stuff you put on the bottom. It would like patch the hole or it would replace the rubber. And so I always played when I was outside. I'd always have this shoe goo all over the bottom of my shoes. And now I think about that, you're like, that had to kind of throw off your, you know, how you land. It had to be feel weird on your feet and whatever, but that was just what you did back then.
Yeah, now you tell me. No, I never used the shoe goo back then.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah, but, you know, even now at Queens, we've got a really thriving camp. And I tell the kids, even though, you know, we all kind of know it is a little bit of babysit camp, but if you come to Queens basketball camp, and I tell them this the first day, it's going to be some old school basketball camp. You know, we can't do exactly what used to be done and when everybody wanted to play, but they're going to learn some fundamentals and they're going to do some stations and coaches are going to coach and the kids are going to learn, otherwise go to tennis camp. Right.
Right. So. Exactly. Yep. For sure. I think that's one of the things that I still think there's a good market for a teaching camp. And because there's just not that many opportunities out there for kids to get exposed to good coaches that are teaching fundamentals, because so much of our system today is based around playing, whether that's AAU or even travel basketball, or you think about the recreation or city basketball that I grew up on, especially in elementary school, where I wasn't traveling anywhere. I was just playing in my own local community. And it's the system now is so different. And I think that there's still pockets out there where if you do a good job with a fundamental camp, that's, you know, quote, an old school camp, I think you can have a tremendous amount of success. And sounds like you're seeing that with your camp at Queens.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. It's funny you say that. I had the fortune of being invited to the Florida High School Coaches Association last weekend, I think. And I spoke to their organization, but after me was Stan Van Gundy, and that was kind of his message, was that you know, the world is kind of caught up to us, and he really thinks that it has a lot to do with our model and how they're learning fundamentals and we're just playing games, and you know, it's really hurting us as the players develop and become older and you know, grown men who are playing international basketball. And it makes a lot of sense because you just don't see the fundamentals being taught as much anymore.
Yeah. Do you think there's a solution to that, Bart? I mean, is there a way, is the cat out of the proverbial bag already and it's going to be hard to stuff it back in? Or is there a way that we can revert back to, and not completely, and again, I think there's positives to the system that we have now, but I also think that there's challenges. And one of those is what you just said is, you know, we're not spending as much time teaching the game. Kids start playing full court games so early. Is there a way that we can reverse that, or you think think the ship has already sailed in a way?
No, I think that we're starting to see some trends, and that, you know, you mentioned the Billis Camp and Snow Valley and some of those that are really trying to make a concerted effort to go back to those models. But basketball, to me, is uniquely positioned. You know, I think if you look at soccer and some of those models where the kids are a little more affluent and the parents are going to pay and there's such a money system, but basketball is really at the youth level, it can be reversed. You know, it's not just a money machine right now. And I think if more professional coaches and high school coaches we'll take the time to teach the grassroots folks, hey, this is what we're trying to do with our system, I think there's still time for basketball to go back to, you know, it'll be a hybrid model with, you know, the kids are going to want to play games. They're not going to want to do drills like we did, but to teach the fundamentals and have more drill work, more skill work. And I think that you're seeing that through the trainers, but I think eventually that's going to morph into the coaches as well. So I do think there's a chance.
What's your take on playing more 3-on-3 or small-sided games with kids at younger ages? Because I've tried to be a proponent on the podcast for getting, let's say, elementary school kids specifically, rather than playing so much 5-on-5 where they're spending a ton of time just running between the 2-3-point lines. Rather, if they're playing 3-on-3, they're getting so many more touches on the ball and just getting more opportunities to be involved in the action. What's your thoughts on 3-on-3 for young kids?
Well, you know, I can only speak really for how I teach my guys, and I know there's a big movement to practice 5-on-5 in college and professionally. But I think, you know, 1-on-1, 2-on-2, 3-on-3, I think that's where you really learn those skills. And, you know, to flip the ball over, I think I use it more maybe on the defensive end. But if you're learning how to properly do a closeout, you know, to me, there's no better way than 1-on-1. If you're learning how to guard ball screens or you're learning how to get through a down screen, you know, I think going 3-on-3 and playing, you know, playing a side of the floor where you're isolated and you're really working on those skills, and then flip it back to the offensive end, you know, you're able to have a little more space and teach. It's really to me, it's hard to teach, you know, skill development and skill development offensively and defensively when you're playing 5-on-5, because, you know, guys get different angles and they can hide a little bit. I think when you break it down to 1-on-1, 2-on-2, 3-on-3, that's when you really get to see, okay, what's sticking. And, you know, when guys got to go out and they got to close a guy out 1-on-1, you really get to find out if they can
absolutely
close out.
Absolutely. There's no doubt about that. Yeah, that's a great point. I think that as a coach, I think a challenge is, and especially, again, depending, I'm thinking now of more of maybe a high school coaching situation or a guy who's coaching middle school or even, you know, a travel coach who might only have one set of eyes. And, you know, you have that one coach trying to coach a 5-on-5 game or doing a 5-on-5 drill per se. And it's really hard to be able to zero in on whatever the fundamental skill is that you're trying to teach. Now, you can do it, and the more experience you have as a coach, the better you can get at it. But I think that's a great point that you've made for anybody who's out there coaching, especially at some of the lower levels, is the more you can break it down into the smaller parts, I think, A, the easier it is for you to see what's being done. And then, B, I also think it's easier for you to teach it in that more controlled environment where you can really isolate that skill to see. As you said, you're still playing live action when it's 1-on-1. It's still dynamic. It's not just, okay, you have to go right, or it's a, you know, a block drill per se. But you still have that dynamic environment, but you're able to isolate the skill that you're really looking for. So I think that's some great advice for young coaches out there, for coaches who are coaching at younger levels.
Yeah, and you know, if you look at the way the NBA, and I think the NBA is still, that, you know, they're the best teachers, and I know they have great players, but they really do teach the game, and they are using so much 3-on-3. You know, it's becoming a big part of the game. Obviously, you've got 3-on-3 becoming a, you know, is it going to be an Olympic sport next Olympics?
Next Olympics.
But I think it's only amateurs, right? Like, it's not, it can't be pros.
I don't know. What it is, you have to, your team or your individual player, you have to qualify and earn enough points through FIBA events in order to be able to be eligible to play. So I think that pretty much eliminates it eliminates our NBA guys. I don't know what it does to foreign pro players, but I think it's going to be a much more, that field is going to be populated more by amateurs, I believe. So, but definitely, I think it's going to shine some light on the game for sure.
It does. And if you watch a good bit of that 3-on-3, the extra space really shows the skill, you know, in 5-on-5, it becomes a more athletic game. But the 3-on-3 with the space, well, you can really see the skill. And, you know, I think that's, you know, as a coach, when I watch that, I think, okay, why don't I have my guys doing more of that? Playing 3-on-3, learning how to play, learning how to read coverages, you know, learning how to properly set a screen. You know, it really isolates all those skills. And for we did it today. You know, we had a couple team practices a week at this time of the year, and we did a lot of 3-on-3 today. We started out 1-on-1, and then we did three different segments of 3-on-3 where we're doing, you know, guarding different things and executing different things offensively.
So when you do a 3-on-3 breakdown like that, do you start out? So you said you did it three different ways. So do you start out with a different action in each one of those three different sets of 3-on-3, or how do you split that up when you're thinking about designing a 3-on-3 drill? Do you start it with like, okay, this time we're always going to start with a pin down screen, or we're always going to start with a ball screen? Now, how do you organize that piece of it?
No, that's exactly it. We've taught a skill. So right now we're really concentrating on closeouts and kind of where our help is coming from. And we're working on ball screen coverage. So those are our focus, half court defensive focuses right now. So our first 3-on-3 was we put the two wings, coach with the ball at the top of the key. The defenders have to be, the guard defenders have to be inside the lane to start, and then you've got a post or a guy on the baseline who is going to go opposite wherever that coach throws the ball. So if he throws it to the right, that offensive player on the baseline will go to the left side, so that bottom guy becomes help. And then when we throw it in, you're working on a closeout because they start in the lane. So you start with a closeout and the other side is a jump to the ball. So, you know, and then from there, we're kind of crazy a little bit. When we play anything less than 5-on-5, there's no out of bounds, and there probably is very little foul calling. So it gets to be pretty intense, and everything is an offensive rebound. So you've got three lines, you know, these six players start, the coach throws it in, there's a closeout, there's help. But when the shot goes up, whoever gets it can put it right back in, and whoever scores is off, and the other team becomes the defense. So
have you always done that with the offensive rebounding piece of it? Because that's something that I forget. I feel like I saw that relatively recently. I can't remember where I was or what coach I saw doing that. I'm like, that's a great idea. Of it just sets up the mentality of having everybody crash the boards and get after the rebound, as opposed to if you don't have that, it just disincentivizes guys from getting to the board. And I think when everybody can go up and get it and score, it just gets everybody to go to the basket harder. So have you done that for a long time, or is that something you picked up from somewhere? Do you even remember where you picked it up?
I've done it my whole career. So that particular 3-on-3, I used to just do it 3-on-3. You know, the guy's got the ball up top, there's two wings, and we're playing. Now I really use it for actions. You know, like today we would go from there and we'd have a ball screen with a loaded side. So you've got a tag, and when they play, they guard the ball screen and it's live from there. But when they shoot, it's an offensive rebound. And really, I mean, you get everybody in there trying to get the ball, everybody trying to stick the ball back in the basket. You can really work on walls. That's when we do call the fouls, is, you know, we don't allow them to foul when they're in the lane against the ball. So they've got to really build walls and make guys miss shots in the lane. So I think it does develop toughness. It develops the habits of going to the glass, and then we try not to foul.
Yeah, I think that's really something that if any coaches are out there and you don't do that when you're playing 3-on-3 or whatever drill you're doing, if you let every team go, both teams go after the offensive rebound, I think it does. I found that when I've used that it definitely gets guys going to the boards a lot harder than they would otherwise if it's just the traditional, you know, okay, you get the rebound and then, you know, new team comes on. I like the idea of having everybody be able to go after those rebounds. I want to skip back, Bart, to what you talked about with Five Star, and just ask you what you remember about Five Star, and then if you've ever talked to any of your current players just kind of about it, because I'm always amazed that you look back on that time and the fact that all the biggest names in basketball back in the 80s and 90s passed through Five Star, and you think about the fact that it was outdoors on tennis courts, it's 90 degrees there at Robert Morris, and yet you look at the stable of coaches that came through there, and you look at the quality of the players that came through, and I think you compare that to today's top 50 players in the country and just the way that their summer experience is. And then you look back on, I love looking at Five Star's website and looking at some of those old pictures of, you know, guys in the 80s and 90s and just, you know, just how the game was different. So can you talk a little about your experience and then just think about, you know, how that might look or compare it to what guys have today, it's just a totally different feel. It's interesting. I think Five Star was the perfect camp at the perfect time.
Yeah, it really was. I remember how hot it was. I remember the station work. I remember how much I learned, how hard we worked. I remember I was late for a meeting and had to get up at like 5:30 the next morning for.
There you go.
Yeah, there was a lot of discipline.
There was a
camaraderie, you know, where, you know, you were out there, you were working, you were competing, but it wasn't just games, you know. Everybody kind of felt like you were getting better, you know, and I feel that with our players, you know, they're okay with working as long as they feel like they're getting better. And I think when you're just playing, you know, you just roll in and you play some games, you know, do you really feel that way? And do you get locked into the love of the game? And I think that's a part of it too. You know, you get out there and you're learning from the best, and you know, they're teaching you, and you're learning how to absorb coaching. So it's not just even the skills. It's just the whole environment. And you learn to look people in the eye and go, okay, I'll do it again. All right, I did it wrong again. Do it again. Okay, I did it wrong again. Let me do it again. And that's the kind of camp it was. And you know, you can talk about the players that were there, and there were lots of great players. You know, the Bobby Hurleys when I was there, and I can't remember if it was Alonzo Mourning, but you know, there were great players, but it was the learning environment. And for me as a basketball junkie, you know, I already knew I wanted to coach. So, you know, I just absorbed all that up. I have notebooks where I took notes, and I might have been a nerd at that point too.
I remember, tell me if this strikes a chord with you. I remember when I was at any of these camps, whether it was Five Star or any of the ones that we talked about earlier, I can remember being in the lines watching whatever was being taught, and then standing in the line and either visualizing what I had to do when I went out on the court, or actually physically like executing the pivot in line to make sure that when I got my turn that I was going to do it right. And that was something that I was very, very conscious of. Do you remember doing anything like that when you were at camps?
Oh yeah. I mean, you didn't want to screw it up, because there were real dudes coaching those drills. they knew what they were doing, and they would some of them were relentless. And you know, I wish I had a roster of the coaches that were there. I'd probably look back and go, holy moly, look at the guys that were coaching. Yeah, I do remember also the lectures. You know, you do the drill work and, you know, play a little bit, and then you'd sit outside and do the lectures. You know, they didn't take you into the some cool air conditioned right. place. I remember Larry Dale Brown, when he was at LSU, he was speaking to the camp, and I remember him telling us about, you know, cutting out popcorn boxes, putting them in the bottom of his shoes when he was playing as a kid, because he didn't have shoes. He should have told him about that shoe goo.
Yeah, shoe goo. We should have got him. We should have got Dale Brown on the shoe goo train.
But it was outside in the heat when he was speaking. It was you know, I don't know if you get away with that these days, but
yeah, I don't think so.
It was a great experience. All those camps were tremendous. Yeah.
I remember Billy Owens was the guy that was there the week that I went to Five Star in between my junior and senior year. And I remember him, he was on cafeteria duty. So he, you know, everybody else be eating and he'd be, you know, picking up trays or, you know, walking around and serving the milk and, you know, doing stuff. And I'm sure that was part of him getting his camp comped at some point back then. But, you know, you just think about, again, his experience. So he was probably, you know, whatever. He was one of the top three high school players in the country. And there he is schlepping milk to, you know, guys like me. And, you know, you think about the experiences that kids have today. And again, no matter where they are, you know, you're playing in a nice air-conditioned gym. You probably got a nice uniform. You got, you know, somebody taking you out to eat in between games and all this stuff. And it's just, again, it's a different environment than it was when you and I were coming up in the game. And I think there's a lot of positives to the, you know, to the environment today. I think that kids in general are probably exposed to better coaching at the team level. Now, when you went to a camp like Five Star, you went to one of those teaching camps like you were fortunate enough to be able to do, or me, I think you got exposed to really good coaching. But I think nowadays, because there's so many more people sort of in the quote basketball business, I think kids at a younger ages generally get exposed to better coaching. Plus, it's so much easier as a coach at any level to educate yourself, whether it's through a podcast like this one or whether it's through books or the internet. You can connect with just about any coach out there in the country that, you know, you send them an email, and most coaches, as we all know, are more than willing to share or open up their practice or just have a basketball conversation with somebody. So I think kids do get exposed to better coaching, but it's a matter of finding that balance between practicing the skills, really working on your game versus just rolling the balls out and playing games. You can't develop your skills just playing 5-on-5. You just don't get enough reps with the ball.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a lot to be said with just the ball in the gym.
Head Start Basketball's Cutthroat Gameplay program returns on Tuesdays in October at the Strongsville Rec Center. Boys and girls in grades 5 through 10, you won't want to miss this one. Come out and join us and get prepared for your season with the best live-action skill development game anywhere. You can register at www.headstartbasketball.com.
You've mentioned a couple times that you always knew that you wanted to be a coach. So when was that point where you knew you wanted to be a coach, or was it something that was always in you because of maybe your exposure from your dad? And then what was it, is it about coaching that you love that made you say, I want to do this for my professional life?
That's a great question. You know, I think for me, it was just the love of basketball. I mean, I really did love it, and I really did live it. And the only thing I ever considered doing other than that was I had a sister who had special needs, and we'd taken her to some hospitals, and thought about, you know, trying to be a doctor, but that was way too much school. I really did watch my uncle and his interactions with his players and how he made them better and how he made them better people. And I saw the impact that he had on their lives, and the combination of being able to live with basketball, you know, and do that for the rest of my life. I really never considered doing anything else. And to this day, you know, that George Raveling always says you got to have an exit strategy. I'm not sure I have.
Not sure what yours is, huh?
Yeah. No idea. And that's probably, you know, I burned the boats at some point when I was young.
That's probably a good thing. So when you finish playing and you get your first opportunity to coach at Winthrop, correct?
Correct.
All right. So talk a little bit about how that came to be, and then what your first experience, had you coached anywhere? Like, had you coached some summer teams or anything before you got before you got your first formal coaching job? Like, you done some, you know, work with youth programs or anything leading up to that? Or was that Winthrop experience really your first experience with coaching?
Really just camps. I think one summer I worked at a YMCA camp in college, you know, but it was a general camp. And then, you know, working basketball camps, obviously, as a college player. But really that was the first time I was really coaching. And, I don't know, the first year, I really just called up Coach Kenny and said, hey, I want to come. And he created a spot. I got a graduate assistant job on campus. And then the following year became what was called the restricted earnings coach, which was at Winthrop at that time was extremely restricted.
I can imagine.
Yeah. Later there was a lawsuit and, you know, the people class action against the NCAA about that position. And I got a check, you know, maybe 10 years later. And that was way more money than I was going to make. So, but you know, I made it work. There was a lot of macaroni and cheese and hot dogs and, you know, just squeaking by. But I was coaching, and then I met a guy named Dale Lair at Queens. He had an assistance job, and I got that job, you know, a couple of years after being at Winthrop, was there with Dale for three seasons and two seasons. And then at 25, he takes the assistant's job at Colorado State. And before I had turned 26, I was the head coach at Queens. I think I was already losing my hair, so they didn't know how old I was.
You and me both. I'm with you. Yeah. I'm right there with you on that.
I've never seen Mike with hair, so.
Yeah, it's been a long time since I've had any. So, and even when I had it, it wasn't good. It probably wasn't worth having around, even when I had some. So, probably should have went to the bald look even earlier than I did.
Yeah, I was going back on D.
Yeah, there you go. That's exactly right. Yeah. So, if you think back to those early years, was there anything that surprised you from a coaching standpoint? Maybe something that you thought was going to be one way, but it ended up turned out to be another, or maybe just something surprising that coaches did that maybe when you were a player that you hadn't realized that coaches had to spend that amount of time doing that particular task. Because obviously now you've been in it for a long time, so you have a pretty good idea of what it takes. But at that point, you know, it's all brand new to you. So was there something that was different than what you thought it was going to be like when you first got into the coaching profession?
Well, one of the big lessons I think I learned at Winthrop, I think I had a lot of knowledge about, you know, the game and about skills and about, you know, how to teach it. But I had no idea about overall philosophy. How do you really want to play? How do you want to run a program? How do you discipline players? How do you keep things together? And really didn't know that was something that I needed to think through. Maybe I was young and naive, but I can remember asking Coach Kenny, you know, how do I develop my philosophy? And he wasn't trying to be rude, but he was like, I really can't tell you that. You got to figure that out for yourself.
That's funny.
I think that it took me a little while to really realize, you know, the lessons that, you know, you don't know exactly what you're going to do, but you need to have a plan. You need to have a plan for how you would go about playing, how you're going to treat your players, you know, how you structure a program, how you structure your practices. You know, who are you as a coach? And as a young person, I think that's the most difficult thing. I often think about these coaches that play at the high levels and have always been assistants, and then say they get the Michigan job as their first head coaching job. Well, that would just scare me to death, because I got Queens and nobody knew where it was, and it hadn't, you know, they hadn't had men for that long and hadn't had basketball for that long, so I could make all kinds of mistakes and nobody you know, kind of run through the break a lot of things, and nobody really knew.
So how did you go about then developing all those different things that you just talked about? How did you start to put together, what's my philosophy going to be? What kind of culture do I want to build? What are the pillars I'm going to build my program on? At what point did you start to put that together, and in what form did you put it together? Was that something that you were putting down in a notebook? Was that something that you were – how were you formalizing that so that when you did eventually get an opportunity, which for you came – maybe quicker than you even expected, how did you go about putting together all those things that you just talked about so that when you did have an opportunity, you were going to be prepared with some of that?
Well, and this is going to sound a little crazy probably, and I'm a slow learner, but I think I was the head coach at Queens and we won a lot of games. I was the head coach at High Point University and we did pretty well. But I don't think until I went to work for Buzz that I put it all together about how to run a program soup to nuts, you know, how to handle everything, how to, you know, bring all of my philosophies together. I knew the game and I knew how to make guys work hard and, you know, had team rules and those kind of things. But I think running a program is a lot more than that. And especially today with today's kids, you've got to be, you know, we call ourselves a cult at Queens. You know, we really do have our own cult. We have our own language. We have our own rituals, our own sayings, you know, our own rhythm of how we do things. You know, I'm much more comfortable with a philosophy of how I deal with administration, and really I learned a lot of that from watching Buzz. You know, as much as I thought I knew basketball, like he knew all that other stuff. It was light years ahead of what it blew my mind to watch him for 3 years at Marquette.
So what were some of the things then that when you look back on your first tenure at Queens, your time at High Point, what were some of the things that you didn't do or you didn't know or you didn't have a grasp on that today you have a much better grasp on as you've gone into your second stint at Queens?
Well, I think it really boils down to making people buy in, not because you know basketball, but because you're creating an environment where they can absolutely thrive and get better, not only in ball but in their entire life, and it's got to bleed over into your university community, into the local community you live in. And you know, for us, we even, you know, with it, with social media, and I think in this day and age, it's got to bleed over to, you know, to nationally and internationally, and where people see what you're doing and they have a chance to buy into what you're doing. And that's what Buzz was so good at. And, you know, it was amazing to watch him because he had been a recruiter all his life. He grew up completely different than I did, you know, and wasn't at all these camps. And, you know, he'd even tease me about, you know, that I knew all that basketball stuff. but he knew how to create an environment where people really bought in. And I think coming back to Queens and having those experiences, you know, I got fired at High Point. I had my first losing season and got fired with a new AD, and you know, at that point I was like, I would never get fired. I was arrogant about it. And but when you have some stumbling blocks, boy, it makes you open up and start to assess, okay, where am I? What am I doing? What am I doing well? What am I not doing well? And I don't know that you don't know what you don't know. And watching Buzz for those 3 years really helped me to really think about, okay, if I get another opportunity, you know, how am I going to go about it? And you know, I think we've tried to, you know, take advantage of that at Queens.
So how did he create that buy-in that you're describing? What was it about his personality? What was it about the way he set up the program, the things that he did? Just maybe give us some concrete examples of things that you feel he did that created the buy-in and that atmosphere that you're describing around the Marquette program and that you've tried to bring to Queens.
Well, it's let me give you some small examples. We have a calendar. A lot of people have a calendar. It's called the elementary school calendar. And so each kid on Sunday gets their calendar where they've got their classes, practice, anything that they have. But Buzz filled up the calendar. You know, there was always there was never a time when those kids didn't have something that they were you know, responsible to do. And he knew where they were and what they were doing. He created an environment where they wanted to be around the office. They wanted to be around, you know, the locker room, you know, things like you got to come by and you got to sign in every day. You've got to, you know, we've got, you know, all programs now at higher colleges have food and things, but you know, he had food in the offices. So come by, there's drinks, you know, in the coaches' offices. You know, there was always, you know, little things. We had a day off, you know, we're always going to get up and have early bird the next day after the day off. So even if we just came in the gym and met and talked for, you know, 15, 20 minutes, it was going to be 7:30 after the day off. There was just a rhythm and a plan with everything, you know. You know, we had every speaker that he could get that could come and talk to the team. He, you know, everybody sees Buzz and they, you know, he does his own little sermons. You know, he probably should have been a preacher. But he, you know, he does those, but he also has guys come in. You know, I watched him, you know, get after guys in practice to the point where it was uncomfortable, really uncomfortable at times. But he could do that because on the back end, he's texting and calling and writing them notes and, you know, talking to their parents and having individual meetings with them. He had great relationships with the guys, and then he could turn around and coach them hard. So I could go on and on. There's so many examples, but really there was no idea that he wouldn't try with our guys.
I think that willingness to, as you just said, try new things and to be open to new experiences. I think one of the things, and you mentioned it as with your example there of the former player getting a job, you know, their first coaching job ever, not after not having had head coaching experience and being under a microscope. I think that that's something that, especially if you've played the game, I think there's a tendency to feel like, as you described when you got your first job, that, hey, I know basketball. I've played basketball for a long time. I understand the game and I know I can teach it. And there's almost this, I don't know if arrogance is the right word, but just this thought process of that's enough. And I know I felt that way when I first started coaching right out of my playing career. And I've said this before, but you know, I coached a JV team the first year that I got done playing. And after 5 minutes of the first practice, I was overwhelmed because there was like 5,000 things that I wanted to try to fix in that first 5 minutes. And I was just one set of eyes. And, you start to realize, I think the older I get, the more I realize that I know less and less about coaching. I think my knowledge of coaching, I feel like it's gone in a negative direction opposite my age in terms of understanding that there's so much that I don't know. And I think that that's what you're describing here is, you know, you thought here you were, you know, a head coach at age 25. When you got your job at High Point, you're one of the youngest Division I head coaches in the country and you're riding high. And yet, you know, now you go into the Marquette program with Buzz and you realize, man, there's so many things that I could have picked up or that I could be doing better, that I could do differently. And so you take the best of those things and you grow and you improve and you get better. And I think that that's something that is a great lesson for all coaches, that no matter where you're at, again, you could be a youth coach, you could be a high school coach, a college coach. There's just so many more opportunities to learn. And there's so much out there that you can look at, evaluate and decide whether or not it makes sense for you to help to build your program. And I think that's what you found when you were at Marquette. What was it like for you going from transitioning from being a head coach for a long time, and then now you go back to an assistant's role? What was that transition like for you?
It was really difficult. I guess being fired was, you know, part of that. It wasn't necessarily by choice. You know, here you are. Okay, you got to go be an assistant. And then I was grateful, you know, that I love George Raveling and his sayings. He always says, you know, you need to plant flowers on your way up because you got to pick them on the way down. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, at some point I planted enough flowers that I was able to pick one with Buzz, and that was a great one. But going in, really, was tough. Without busting myself up too much, I was hired as the ops guy, but I was coaching. We didn't necessarily, you know, obey some of those rules.
Understood.
But I was in the guts of practice coaching, and the basketball part was good, but it was all the other stuff that was really difficult, because when you go to that level, you know, you're a specialty. Everybody's a specialty guy. You know, you're the recruiter, you're the coach, you're the scouting report guy, you're the, you know, the video guy. So, you know, it was tough because for a long time I had called the shots and, you know, made the decisions and I think the first year I struggled with it. Second year was a lot better. The third year I was in a groove. you know, there. But I love my time. If you ever talk to anybody else that worked for Buzz, they'll tell you that you're in a blender for 3 years. you're not sure when you come out of it how you feel about it. But when you look back, you go, wow, that was a pretty good little smoothie we just made. So it was good, but it did take some adjustment.
Do you think that having previously been a head coach and then going back into the assistant role, were there things that you maybe recognized because you had been a head coach? Were there things that you were able to recognize that he needed from you that maybe if you had only been an assistant up to that point that maybe you might not have recognized? In other words, did your head coaching experience and working with your own assistants enable you to have a better understanding of what Buzz needed as the head coach at Marquette from you as an assistant?
Yeah, I think it did. I think the biggest thing it allowed me to do was to see where there were little gaps in what we were doing, whether it was, you know, we're not spending enough time with this kid, or you know, maybe when we're warming up pregame, you know, it doesn't look like we're getting enough of this or that. So there were little, you know, overall things that I think being a head coach helped with. I think the biggest thing that it helped me with is I understood that Buzz's time was precious, and that you know, you couldn't go in. The hardest thing as an assistant is you want to go in, you want to attack your head coach, and you want to get his attention and you want to get his time. And I knew that, you know, I couldn't do that with Buzz, and I had to figure out, all right, how do I speak his language? Because I would end up doing every all the assistants had scouting reports, but I did every scouting report, and I did them for Buzz to game plan. So I had to figure out, okay, how do I get all the information to Buzz in the most concise way, in the language that he needs. And he speaks, because Buzz is all about numbers, and you know, he would much rather have an email than a conversation, because there's so many people that are trying to get at him. So I think being a head coach allowed me to understand some of those things that he was going through that I could help. And I tell my assistants that now, you know, I look at my athletic director and I tell myself, how do I take something off of her plate? And I think for my assistants, you know, the greatest thing they can do for me is, hey, help me take something off of my plate. And that's what I tried to how I tried to look at Buzz, and, you know, what can I do? You know, there's 800 people running around this office, and sometimes it's insane. But how can I help him and take something away from him that he doesn't have to spend his time on?
So what's an example of something that you were able to take off his plate? You mentioned the scouting reports and making sure it was in a format that was conducive to the way that he liked to have things done. But what are one or two things that maybe you as an assistant said, ooh, I recognize that he doesn't like to do this, or I recognize that this is something that's going to make his life easier? Can you point to one or two examples that you remember from that time at Marquette?
Yeah. There was a time where I could tell he was really frustrated with the way our practices were starting. You know, he wanted to do the skill work in the 15 minutes beforehand. But Buzz wouldn't really come out and tell you a lot of things, but you could just tell that he was uncomfortable with how practice was starting. When he walked in the gym, he wanted there to be more energy. He wanted there to be more pop. And, you know, I could tell he was trying to convey that, but, you know, I don't think as a staff and as a program, the players were kind of, you know, we weren't doing the job that he wanted. So I reorganized how we started practice and what we were doing when he came in the gym, so that he saw energy, he saw sweat, he saw that, hey, I can walk in, because he didn't want to deal with the, you know, the dynamic stretching and, you know, the guys getting their, you know, their you know, three pointers up and, you know, or whatever work was being done. He wanted to come in and he wanted to get rolling at 1,000 miles an hour. So, you know, that was something that I was able to take off of his plate, so that he could walk in and it started and it was ready to roll. But you have to kind of be looking for that. You know, he didn't come out and say, hey, somebody take control of this and, you know, and make this better. Sometimes you gotta anticipate that that's a problem and take it off his plate.
Yeah, good lesson for assistant coaches out there to keep your eyes open and see where you can add value to your head coach and your program overall to just make it better. While you were there at Marquette, you had an opportunity to coach several guys that have gone on to have some success in the NBA. So can you talk maybe a little bit about your experiences coaching Jay Crowder and coaching Jimmy Butler and getting a chance to work with those guys and maybe talk about what, obviously other than just their basketball talent, but was there things that separated them from a, whether it's a work ethic, whether it's a skill level, just their mentality? Just talk a little bit about what your experiences were like coaching players at that high of a skill level that, you know, they were able to go on and have really good careers in the NBA.
Yeah. You know, I think, I truly believe that the grinder that was that time at Marquette really helped Jay and Jimmy, especially, become the players that they are now. You know, when I first got there, you know, Jimmy was a role player and he was a backup and he was just starting to figure it out that he could be good. And but it really was the grind, and it was them learning how to work and completely committing themselves, to being able to be everyday guys. And you know, if you watch Jimmy now and Jay too, you know, part of the reason they make the money they make is what they do defensively, and they move with the ball. And I can just remember Buzz grinding those guys out in shell for rep after rep after rep after rep, and the boot camps and the individual workouts. And I mean, it was relentless. And you know, what it taught me, and those guys really embraced it, and they still embrace it, which is why they're, you know, some of the best in the world, is it is talent, and both those guys are talented. But it really is, when you boil it down, if you don't work at it, there's a few guys that God said, hey, this guy's an NBA player, and you know, he's LeBron James, and you know, that LeBron still has to work, but he's going to be an NBA player. You know, Jimmy Butler wasn't that. You know, Jay Crowder wasn't that. You know, they developed into that through the everyday grind. That's why the one and dones and all that. I think that when they don't have that college experience where they fail, and I think that it hurts them as pros. And I think those are the struggles Jimmy's had in the NBA. You know, he sees guys that maybe don't understand that grind, and he's like, you know, we're not gonna win big unless we work. And he knows that he worked to get there, and he's not going to take less than that.
Yeah, I think that work ethic, and you said it really, really well, in that there's a certain level of talent, athleticism, size, whatever, that you have to possess in order to have the potential to be an NBA player. But there's not a lot of guys who are going to put in that work and are going to do the things that are necessary to be able to get to that level. And then once you get there, you got to keep working. And if you don't, it's very easy. I'm sure the pro game will very easily, chew you up and spit you out if you're not working hard, unless you're just unbelievably gifted. And I think that, you know, if you look at team dynamics, and you mentioned it there with, you know, Jimmy's potential frustration and the situation that he had in Chicago and in Minnesota, where, you know, again, you wonder what was going on behind the scenes in terms of his expectation of what work he was putting in, and then, you know, the time that maybe he felt like other players, you know, were putting in. And I think he's a testament to a guy who came in as, you know, not a huge big time recruit, but was a guy who put the time in to improve himself and get better and really work at it. And I think that if you're a player and you're not going to put the work in, you're not going to get the success out of it that you're looking for. And I think that goes to everything that you've been talking about from a coaching standpoint, which is you want to try to create as a coach an environment where your players can learn and they can grow and they can improve. And it sounds like that's exactly the environment that Buzz had created there for those guys, that it was the perfect situation for them to be able to grow and develop their game and become the players that they eventually did, so they could make a living playing basketball, which is a pretty good opportunity.
Yeah. And, you know, I'll give you an example. You know, I've seen guys go the other way. Jimmy goes the last pick of the first round and plays this. He was in a good situation where they valued defense in Chicago. But after that first year, he goes back to Tomball, Texas, brings two guys that he knows are just about work. They rent a house. They don't have a TV in the house. They don't have a PlayStation or whatever, the Xbox, whatever they had then. And they worked out four times a day. They basically ate, slept, and worked out. And Jimmy goes in the next year and becomes the most improved player in the NBA. And, you know, eventually an all-star and an Olympian. And there just aren't any secrets. It's, you know, that's, you know, it's the story I use with our guys. You know, there's no secrets. It's just work. If you really want to be good at something, you've got to have a singular focus and you got to work at it.
Is that something with your guys now that you're sharing on a daily basis, just through, you know, quick snippets of, you know, in between drills and just as you're going through and talking about it? How are you getting that message across day to day with your guys at Queens right now?
Yeah, I mean, those are the examples we use. A lot of what we do is really, really simple, especially here in the preseason. It's mic and drills, but they've got, you know, if they're a post player, they got 30 seconds, they gotta get, you know, 23 or 24. And, you know, I'll tell them, hey, you know, Jimmy Butler could get 26, you know, we get a zigzag drill, a zigzag drill where you've got a ball handler in each corner and you're zigzagging the ball handler up, and then the defense stays on and you get a fresh offensive player, which is brutal. You know, but we go for 45 seconds, and, you know, I can tell them stories about how hard Buzz pushed those guys and how Jimmy could keep going. You know, I tell them, you know, they're a bottle and I'm going to try to knock them over and see what comes out and help them pick their bottle up, try to knock it over again. And until I can't knock their bottle over anymore. And Jimmy got to the point where, you know, Buzz could do whatever, run whatever, and couldn't knock his bottle over. He just kept going. So, you know, to me, that's true toughness, and that's what's, you know, that's what's made him a millionaire.
Yeah, it's a great lesson for players that are out there, you know, listening, is that, you know, you can always push yourself one degree further than you think you can. And I think that's a great lesson to take away from that you know, sometimes it takes a coach to initially get you to believe that you can do that. And then once it really becomes a player belief and the player has the confidence, the knowledge that they can do it, that they can push themselves past that limit, and they don't become, or they're no longer reliant on the coach to get them to that level, that's where you really have somebody like Jimmy Butler who can take off and just be like, hey, I'm locking myself in a house for the entire summer, and I'm going to work, and I'm going to improve, and I'm going to get better. And that wasn't a coach pushing him to do that. That was him taking the lessons that he had learned throughout his lifetime, and, you know, from Buzz and from you and from the other coaches there at Marquette, to be able to take that and say, now I'm going to take what I've learned and I'm going to run with it. And that's where you really have true success. And I think that goes to players at any level. It doesn't just have to apply to an NBA player, because there are lots of guys out there obviously playing the game who don't have the physical tools to be able to play in the NBA, but it doesn't mean that they can't maximize the tools that they have. And I think that you or any coach, that's really what you're trying to do, is you're trying to get the most out of every single player, both as a basketball player and as a human being.
Head Start Basketball's fall skill development clinics will be held at the Strongsville Rec Center on four consecutive Saturdays in October. These skill clinics will be from 4 to 6 p.m. beginning on October 5th. The skills clinics are for boys and girls in grades 1 through 8. If you're looking for a great way to get prepared for your season, sign up for the Head Start Basketball fall skill development clinics at www.headstartbasketball.com.
You know, there's always guys that that don't have great physical ability. You know, we have some guys on in our program that are unbelievable athletes. But there are other guys who are just as effective because they're great listeners, they're great workers, they've really dedicated themselves to the program and learning how we do things and why we do things. And those guys have tremendous, tremendous value. And I think too often, we forget that, you know, basketball, a lot of times with the internet and with the way training goes, you know, we look so much of it as individual. There's nothing individual about basketball. You know, you're a part of a team. You're a part of a team. And, again, go back to tennis, you know, if you want it to be about you, go play tennis. You really, if you've got a burning desire to be a part of a team, all you got to really do is listen to everything that's going on and play as hard as you can. And eventually you're going to find some value.
So how do you build that team camaraderie into what you're doing day to day at Queens, whether it's on the practice floor, whether it's in the basketball offices, whether it's on campus? What do you do to build your relationships with your players and then to foster the relationships between your players themselves so that you can build that cohesive family team unit that you want to build? How do you go about doing that?
Well, I think first of all, the culture of work, and we've talked a lot about that. But then if you talk about off the floor, I had the fortune to be around a guy named Dr. Joe Carr, who is a sports psychologist. He works with a lot of NBA teams. He's worked a lot with LeBron. He always tells the story about, I don't remember the year, but it was in LeBron's early career. He had some trouble in the playoffs with his emotions. Well, Dr. Carr had sessions with him and I guess also with LeBron's mother together. But he taught LeBron he called it his warrior's mask, and he would put on his warrior mask and he would show no emotion. And I don't know if you guys remember those playoffs where he would just come out stone faced, and that was Dr. Carr working with him. But there was an NBA lockout, and so I had the fortune of seeing Dr. Carr work with one of our teams, and he really was able to do some things that he called opening doors. And it really was as simple as allowing your players to talk about themselves and their families and where they came from, and you know, and giving them, we would sit in a circle and we'd pass a ball around and he'd call the ball the cake, and you could only speak if you had the cake. But what they did was they told about, you know, how they grew up, and I have three brothers and one sister, and these are their names, and this is how things have worked for me, and these are the good things that have happened to me in my life, and here's some bad things that have happened. And I really opened my eyes, because, you know, I realized a lot of these guys, they're teammates and they're tight, but they don't even know how many brothers and sisters each of them have. And they don't know much about, you know, what happens back home, or, you know, what troubles they've had. And the other thing it did is it brought them together, because you might have a kid from a, you know, from a very affluent family and a kid over here from a poor family. But once they tell their stories, they realize, you know, we're not that different.
Yeah, right.
You know, everybody's got a story. And so, you know, I think the more you can do, and I think going bowling and things like that's a little, you know, we don't do much of that kind of stuff. You know, we do try to go out and help other people through community service. I think that's a great lesson to learn. But really, we want to learn how to talk to each other, how to really know each other, how to know our backgrounds, and how to relate. And I think those are some of the valuable things I've learned along the way.
So are you doing that on the practice floor? Are you doing that in the locker room? Are you doing that during team meeting time? When are you having those kinds of conversations? Or is it more of just a, you know, an informal thing where, you know, you might have a conversation with two or three guys? How do you go about structuring that to make sure that you're intentional about having guys develop those kinds of relationships?
Yeah, we do the opening doors as a team, and it's away from the practice floor. So we haven't done it yet with this team, but it'll probably be on a Sunday evening where we've got, you know, it takes a long time. It takes about 4 hours to really get through it. And, you know, I have had other coaches say, you know, some of the things that they tell us, I'm not sure we want to know. But it really, I think it does bring you together. I'm a big believer in little sayings, you know, a theme for the year. You know, we have a theme every year, and it's always something to do with where our program is, but there's always a component of we just worry about today, and doing today right, and then wake up tomorrow and do tomorrow the right way again, and stacking good days on top of each other. In I guess, you know, what people call a process. And we really do stress that we're gonna do today right. So we always have a theme that, you know, has something to do with our program, and then always, you know, one time it was one O-N-E, but it was only now exists. One year it was just today. So we incorporate those things, and I think little things that are just for your group, you know, we'll put that on their practice gear. And so they know what it is, and hopefully nobody else does. So we want to keep our cult going. But you know, there's little things like Buzz used to always take the hand sanitizer before practice and call it the juice. And I stole that from him. So every day before we get rolling, we'll go around and I juice everybody up. I give them hand sanitizer, and, you know, but it's those little rituals. It's those little things that make you tight and make those guys feel like they're a part of something bigger than themselves.
Yeah, I think when you can create a unique environment and you create that sort of insider feeling that, hey, we're all together in this, and you get your guys to bond over things that, you know, you mentioned, like your team slogan. It's such a, again, from somebody on the outside, you could see him looking at that and going, boy, that's silly. You know, why do these guys put this, you know, weird saying on a t-shirt and think that it makes a difference? But it does. You know, I don't think there's any doubt that when you can put something on paper, on a t-shirt, and then you can build that into your daily ritual, you can build that into your mentality, you can build that into every single thing that you do as a team, there's no doubt that brings you together and has you come out stronger on the other end. And I just think that by creating those kinds of slogans, you end up with a tighter team if you figure out ways that you make it real for the players. And I know that I've said this before, but, you know, players can smell a fraud very, very easily. And so when you do things and the players see that you care about them, and they see that you're genuine, they see that you're living those same principles that you're asking them to live by, that's when I think you really truly have success, and when all the players will buy into it, when they see you, your staff, and everybody on board, everybody's rowing in the same direction, that's when you can really have sustained success. And it sounds like that's what you've been able to build to this point at Queens.
Well, it's funny you say that, because I think that's we talk as a staff, we talk about we better bring the right players in now, because I think that's what culture is, because now we have a culture where guys are working and they want to, you know, they want to do well, they want to do right, and they know what it's about. And, you know, guys graduate, and we've got other guys that are coming through the program, but they pass those lessons along. And they can smell, you know, they not only can smell a fraud in the coaches, but if we bring a kid who's a fraud, well, it doesn't take long, you know.
Right.
Once you get that culture rolling, you got to make sure that you bring the right guys, because, you know, that they can be relentless. You know, they defend that culture, and they take pride in it, which is, I guess, where you want to be.
Yeah, it's exactly where you want to be. Talk a little bit about, it's a good segue to your recruiting process. Talk a little bit about how you first go about identifying kids, sort of the first round of, hey, here's some kids that potentially we're interested in, that fit our culture, that seem like they would fit in with our university and our program, and then how you slowly whittle that down, and then what just how you end up with the guys that you end up with. Kind of take us through the recruiting process from beginning to end as best you can without, you know, getting into obviously too specific of information.
Right. Well, I think we start every conversation with, you know, how we play. So we, especially on the defensive end and really the offensive end as well. So we pick up and we play man to man 94 feet, and it's not crazy. It's just full court man, you know, but you got to be able to zigzag the ball and be able to move your feet. And so, you know, that's something that we value, guys that move their feet defensively, have a good base, are long. And then on the offensive end, you know, we're very analytics driven, where we shoot threes, we get it to the rim, we get to the free throw line. So, you know, we want guys that can dribble, pass, and shoot, and but are athletic enough that, you know, that they can do what we're going to do defensively. And, you know, it sounds easy, but it whittles a lot of it down.
Absolutely.
And then once we get, you know, once we get some guys that you know, we feel like, you know, can physically do what we want them to do, and skill wise, you know, we really value winning, and we really value guys that want to be pros. That doesn't mean they're going to be necessarily NBA players, but they want to play after college. And you know, we've had 18 of those guys in 6 years at Queens that have gone on to play somewhere. But I think if you're going to work the way we work and commit to our culture, you know, it's difficult if you're just going, okay, I'm going to go get this business job after these 4 years.
Right. Exactly.
So, you know, and then winning, you know, we've really, and this isn't a hard, fast rule, but there, you know, if you look at the bios in our program, there's a lot of guys that have won a lot of games, a lot of state championships. I just think that's a, you know, that's a marker. You know, there's some things that translate. Rebounding translates. I think winning translates. You know, you learn how to win, and you learn how to taste that winning, and you want more of it. So, you know, there are kids that we've taken, you know, that didn't have that success in the past, but we put a really high value on, you know, guys that have won at a high level. And then, you know, Queens is the kind of place where you've got to be a serious student. You've got to have, you know, you can't hide, you know, you can't. So there's a huge character piece. And if there's one thing that I could tell a young coach that I've learned, is you can win games with talented guys, but you're only going to win championships if you have high character guys. And always sacrifice that talent for character.
Couldn't agree more. Where do you start your process? Like, how do you go about identifying let's say you got 50 guys on your radar, where does your initial list of guys you're going to start looking at, where does that come from? Does it come through your relationships with high school coaches, with AAU coaches? Does it come through your assistant coaches just kind of being out and on the recruiting trail and hearing things and seeing things? Where does that initial list of prospects of guys that you start the recruiting process with, where does that come from?
I think it mostly comes from just us being out and about, having guys come through our elite camps, having guys, you know, in our gym. We've got a lot of events. Like, you were there for the Billis camp. You know, we had the North Carolina public school camps in our facility. We're out. We have really stressed being out into the high school programs, you know, as much or more. You know, for me, July, going out watching, you know, 1,000 AAU games, I've never had a lot of success with that. I just don't think there's a lot of structure. There's not a lot of, you know, a guy was just picked up by this team last week, and I just don't get a lot out of it. I can tell if he can run and jump and if he can make a three. But, you know, they're not running much. And I don't want to disparage AAU. You know, we do watch a lot of it. But I really like to see guys in their high school structure. And I love to go watch practices. I love to see what, how they act in practice. And so we get the names from all over. You know, I've been in the state for a long time and, you know lots of people. And, you know, a lot of times coaches will contact me when they've got somebody they think is a good fit. You know, and then we'll get out and go see them. It's funny because when I first got back to Queens, I really wanted to do North Carolina well and recruit well here at home in Charlotte. But we took a lot of kids from all over, just because we really had to get the program rolling and cast a wider net. And it seems like the more success we have, the more that, that area that we're going out to, and we'll still have, you know, a kid here and there, from outside, but, a lot of our guys are straight North Carolina guys now. And I think we're doing a pretty good job in the state.
Yeah. It's interesting how that morphed. I think one of the things that you said that I found to be the most interesting is that how much emphasis you place on their high school experience and watching them play as a high school player. And I've talked to a couple other coaches about this, and especially high school coaches, where we've talked to several high school coaches where their players have been recruited and they've barely had conversations. Or in one case, we had a coach whose player ended up going and playing Division I basketball, who had the high school coach and the coach of the college had never had a conversation. And when I heard that from him, I was floored. I'm like, how do you not, as a college coach, how could you not be interested in what that kid does as part of their high school program? Because to me, and you said it best, is you want to see what that player looks like in a structured setting versus the AAU setting. And that's not to say that every AAU program is completely unstructured and that they don't occasionally run things and do whatever, but obviously it's not to the same level that you're going to see in their high school program. And I always felt that as a college coach, I would want to evaluate how the kid plays within a system or within a structure. And that's not necessarily to say that I'm running the same system as his high school, but certainly now when you watch him play in high school, you're going to get an idea of how they fit in and how the things that they do can fit into a structured offense or a structured defensive system versus when you're just kind of watching them, as you said, run up and down the floor in AAU. And yeah, you can tell, are they fast or can they jump? And, you know, maybe what kind of individual skills they have. But I think it's got to be very difficult from an AAU standpoint to evaluate how that player is going to fit into your system. And so I think it's interesting that, again, you said that you'd want to look for more of their high school experience. So to that end, how much time do you spend talking to their high school coach and other people sort of in their immediate circle to try to get a read on some of the things that you value, like their work ethic and their character?
Well, I think that's, you know, that's why I like to see them in their high school setting. You know, it's when it's summertime and it's warm and it's, you know, you're juiced up, it's easy to get excited to play. You know, everybody's excited when you go to those events. But when you go into a high school practice and you've had to go to school all day, and, you know, how do you show up for practice? Because however they show up for that practice is how they're going to show up for my practice. Because we don't play in the summertime. You know, it's not all, McDonald's and go hoop.
You're not just rolling the balls out and, you know, have the free Gatorade over on the side. That's not how you're running things.
Yeah, that's not how it really works. So, you know, for us, I want to know, this is a $50,000 a year investment. When we give a scholarship out for the university, I want to know, you know, how do they treat their teachers? Do the teachers like them? Does the principal like them? Does the high school coach like him? You know, does he work hard for him? You know, because if he goes in and, you know, he's dogging it for that guy, he's going to dog it for me. You know, there's nothing special about me. I'm just another coach. You know, I learned a long time ago, you're not going to change people. But boy, you go in and this kid's gone to class all day and all of a sudden, you know, it's a defensive drill and he's barking and he's getting after it. Like, okay, now we're talking, you know, And we can win with guys like that. And I think that's where we've had success. We've been able to identify some guys that maybe weren't on the, radar of the scouting services or the greatest on the AAU circuit. But boy, you go watch them in the right setting and, I'll take that guy on my team any day.
Yeah, I think that work ethic and character are two things that are, one, difficult to evaluate at first glance in a lot of cases. And it does take digging a little bit deeper and finding out more about that player, not just as a player, but also as what kind of person they are. And, you mentioned it, talking to their teachers and talking to a guidance counselor or talking to a friend or talking to, a parent, anybody that can give you some better intelligence about what kind of a person and what kind of a work ethic they have. And to your point, when you find somebody who's maybe not on those scouting services, who isn't a top 250 player in the country, but somebody who has the work ethic to be able to improve and get better and be in a program like yours where you're going to demand that they work hard and then they're going to demand from each other that they work hard. Now you start to polish those diamonds in the rough, and that I'm sure is what has allowed you to have the kind of success that you've had in your second stint there. We're coming up close, Bart, to an hour and a half. So I want to wrap things up by asking you to share your contact information, how people can reach out to you. And then if there's anything else that we didn't hit on tonight, if you want to share one final parting thought, and then we'll come back and wrap up the episode.
Sure. So they can get a hold of me. My email is LundyB, LUNDY, B as in boy, at queens.edu, QUEENS.edu. And I'm looking for the Twitter deal.
I probably should know it because we just were looking it up, but
it's Coach Bart Lundy.
It's at Coach Bart Lundy. Yep.
There you go. Jason's on it.
Jason is all over that. Feel free to reach out. The only thing that we didn't talk about that I always think is an interesting thing that we do. And, this is something that I don't share. We've made our own, little dictionary. Buzz used to call it the words we use. We just call it our language, but I think you develop your own language and a lot of times you have it in your program and you don't recognize it, but I always want our guys to use the same words and we've actually documented that, and it's helpful not only for our new players and our old players know that we're going to use the words that we use. There's a lot of ways to call different actions in basketball, and whether it's a down screen or a pin down, we're going to use the words that we use and use the same language. So our new guys learn it, but then our assistant coaches learn it, and it's always there and it's always developing and it becomes its own little entity. So I think that's something that we've done that's unique and kind of cool, and our guys really like it. And again, we've got our own cult, so you got to have your own language.
Love that. Do you distribute that in written form to your freshmen when they come in?
Yeah, we do. We do.
That's awesome.
We give them our dictionary, so that's they get a little more studying than they.
One more
but
class.
It's good. It helps.
Very cool. That's awesome. It's very cool. I can see where that brings guys together and makes them feel like they're a part of something special. Bart, we can't thank you enough for spending an hour and a half with us tonight. It was a lot of fun going through and walking through your basketball journey with you. And to everyone out there, we will catch you on our next episode. Thanks.
Thanks for listening to the Hoopheads podcast presented by Head Start Basketball.